I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative. Seasoned producer and storyteller, Lisa Valencia Svensson is an Emmy Award-winning Canadian filmmaker and is currently the industry program director for Toronto's Hot Dog Cinema. Her works and contributions include critically acclaimed films Call Center Blues, Always in Season, Migrant Dreams, and the globally recognized documentary Call Her Gunda, which covered the 2014 murder of a Filipino trans woman in the Philippines by a U.S. Marine. Gunda is the Filipino Tagalog dialect word for beautiful. Today, Lisa shares her thoughts on the film industry and the status of BIPOC stories, what efforts are needed to make the industry more inclusive and accessible, and the stories that she hopes to see in the future.
Yes, I'm Lisa Valencia Svensson, and I'm the Acting Industry Program Director at Hot Dogs. I started producing documentaries way back in 2005, and right away I started working with a Toronto director of Korean origin, Min Suk Lee, and we had already had experience as programmers on CKLN Radio, which was Ryerson's radio station and community radio station, back in the 90s, and that was a very progressive, politically progressive radio station. And so we were already well-versed in the fact that as people of color, as Asian people, those were the stories that we wanted to highlight in our storytelling. So the type of programming that we were already doing on CKLN Radio a decade earlier, it was certainly now the type of programming or material that I wanted to be part of creating. And so from 2005 right up until 2018, when the most recent film that I worked on, Call Her Gunda, which is a story about set in the Philippines, or it's a documentary about a situation in the Philippines, all of the films where I have a producer credit are directed by Black or people of color. And that was a deliberate choice on my part, and it was fairly hard to do, especially the further back we go, because there were fewer BIPOC directors around to work with. And it was certainly very hard to get interest in the stories that we were telling. I think that has all shifted in the past 2, 3, 4 years. And I was just reflecting earlier today that the stories that we tried to pitch, were received with the usual, oh, that's too niche, or there's not an audience. Those stories now would be heavily embraced because there's such a rush now to tell BIPOC stories. And I was feeling a little bit resentful and frustrated about the fact that my career was thwarted because I came up too early when the appetite in white Canada for our stories wasn't yet there.
She comments on Filipinos choosing to work in the film and arts industries, which are not considered traditional or stable careers in the culture. While she says she was fortunate to have a supportive family for her career choice, she knows it is not always the case for most Filipinos.
Yeah, I am half Filipino. My mother came from Manila to North America in the 50s, but I really was not raised with much connection to Filipino community at all, unfortunately. So my choice of work was not really affected by a whole Filipino family or Filipino community telling me, well, that's not what Filipinos do. I was heavily, light brown on the outside, white on the inside culturally. And so my choice made sense. I also came from a family. My mother's family was a fairly artistically oriented family in terms of work. So it didn't really seem a weird career choice to my mother. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I know that for a lot of Filipinos, it is a weird career choice, and it's frowned upon. It's maybe not seen as a very lucrative one or a very stable one. I think it just, for Filipino Canadians who are thinking to move into arts and culture and media production, journalism, film, television, hopefully there's a growing number of organizations, Filipino organizations or groups, Facebook groups, networks, whatever, or people of color or BIPOC networks that they can join so that they can feel less alone, so that they can get those resources and the support, and they kind of know how to respond. I also think that since the murder of George Floyd, it's become all the rage, certainly in Canada, to focus suddenly on BIPOC stories. I think that's great. I think it's, you know, a couple of hundred years overdue, maybe 400 or 500 years overdue, but we'll take it. And so hopefully it is now getting involved in the telling of these stories, or just in the telling of our stories, or telling of stories by BIPOC people will be seen as less strange, will be seen as a more valid career choice, and there will be more role models to point to. It's like, well, look, this person from the Filipino community did this, maybe in the US or maybe in Canada, so I can too, and they've had success. And, you know, hopefully it will build slowly.
In terms of the film industry today, Lisa says efforts have been made to include more BIPOC stories, but believes there should be a fundamental understanding of why change needs to happen. This includes more diversity in leadership roles and accurate representation in film for BIPOC audiences.
Media and cultural and arts institutions in this country have just been myopic and very white and very middle class and very establishment since they've been started. There are some exceptions here and there, but I think there still is a long way to go in terms of getting more Black, Indigenous, people of color into positions of leadership in the arts, culture, film, TV, media, journalism, industries and sectors in Canada. And then I think we'll see the field change more deeply. I think right now it's that superficial, everyone's jumping onto the bandwagon. I think it's good. I think people are actually getting funding dollars. They're actually building their credits. They're actually building their careers, their CVs because of it. But I think the deeper levels of understanding why change is needed, and therefore the deeper levels of commitment to making change happen, that will take time. I think a lot of people don't understand why we need it. And I think they don't understand that for all of our lives, Black, Indigenous, people of color, we've not seen ourselves accurately reflected back to us. And so we all collectively, in different ways, but we struggle with a messaging that we've received all our lives that we are less important than white people. And of course, Black people or Indigenous people have received specific messaging to themselves as well. And so it's that deep psychological effect on all of us, where those of us, Black, Indigenous people of color, we're spending our whole lives thinking we are not quite as important, and white people are spending their lives thinking we are more important. And shifting that in all of our psyches, that's the real change. And once people understand that's why we need this, then I think their commitment will deepen. I think the other part of the why is once you shift our psychological understanding of ourselves and our importance and worth in relation to other people, whether it's white people thinking we're worth more, or BIPOC people thinking we're worth less, or perhaps Black people, or Asian people thinking we're worth more than Black people, etc., you know, because there is a lot of anti-Black racism, certainly in the Filipino community and in other Asian communities, then we will also, that will lead ultimately to changes in how money is spent, changes in policy, changes in how programming is offered, changes in how immigration rules are established and set, changes in who's let into the country, changes in who is being targeted by the police, changes in whose education is being supported, changes in who are perpetually hired as contract workers, changes in who the healthcare system is not serving adequately, and so disproportionate numbers of certain groups of people die of COVID, et cetera. Like, we want concrete changes. So first you have to change the story being told, then you have to, that will change people's understanding of our, all of our worth in relation to each other. And then we decide, oh, wait, they're equally as important, but wait, their housing is substandard, their education, their medical care. Oh, we want to change that. So to me, that's the through line. And I think a lot of people don't see that the ultimate goal of diversifying stories is not just, oh, now we hear more stories, how interesting. No, it's because we want these actual, very concrete social and political and economic changes so that there's more equality for everyone. At least that's what I want. So that's why I fight for better representation in storytelling and media making. Because that's just the tool.
For the future, she advises more in-depth training and mentorship that can help uplift the next generation of BIPOC filmmakers, as well as BIPOC-owned production companies that can ensure stories are accurately and fairly told.
I think steps are being taken in Canada to make increasing amounts of funding available. That's key. You know, you can't tell the stories well unless you're paid. You have the money to do it. I think also training and mentorship, but real, not like, oh, look, you can hang out for a while. Okay, nice to see you. But like, no, we want to train you up to replace us, that kind of training and mentorship. And I think ultimately one area that I'm really focused on right now with others is how do we build up the expertise and experience and capacity of BIPOC owned and operated production companies. So this is more in the film and TV production world, not so much journalism or other areas, so that those companies are trusted to get the big dollar commissions. Because still what's happening right now is that BIPOC are by and large assigned a smaller portion of the pie, because those with the experience who are trusted by the funders and the broadcasters and the commissioners and so forth are still predominantly white owned and led. And so that's, there's still a skew, and it's a financial, it's rooted in finance and experience. And so we have to shift that by building up the capacity of BIPOC owned and operated production company. That's what I'm focused on right now. That has to happen, or we'll always remain at a certain level where the copyright is still owned and controlled by white-led production companies.
For more Filipino representation stories in North America, she wanted to set an example with Call Her Ganda, showing that there's both appeal and interest in these types of stories.
Just in terms of representation of Filipino stories in Canada and North America, I think there's still an absolute absence of that in the mainstream media. And that is why I was one of the producers on Call Her Ganda, which ended up broadcasting in the US on POV, on PBS. And that was one of the first Filipino directed and produced documentaries that I was aware of in North America at that level of broadcast. And it was our attempt to both get a story about the Philippines into North American media at that level of broadcast, and also to hopefully act as a role model or an example that other Filipino filmmakers and media makers can now be like, okay, they did that. We're gonna surpass what they did. But you know, just to push it forward, that was. We wanted to make that film, but I certainly wanted more broadly to just push forward Filipino representation and attention in the industry that I work in.
Hot Docs recently screened the Filipino-American film Fanny as part of the Drive TO events this summer. Lisa believes in celebrating these types of project that gained attention by both the festival circuit and the general public.
And, you know, the group, Fanny, was comprised of three women who were half Filipino, half white, and other members as well who weren't of Filipino origin. It's one of the few stories that I've, few documentaries I've ever been aware of to tell the story, again, at that sort of level of broadcast and festival attention, to tell the story of Filipino North Americans. The director is not of Filipino origin. She's great. She's very devoted to the story and works hard. And I think we are to celebrate this and learn their story, and then to take it one step further. And now let's get Filipinos in North America to tell our stories. That's just the next step forward.
Mm. For future ideas, Lisa wants to see more stories about the Filipino Live-In Care Program in Canada. The program allows Filipinos, mostly women, to come to Canada as live-in caregivers or nannies for 2 years. This gives them the opportunity to apply for permanent residency afterwards. The program, however, continues to receive scrutiny and heavy criticism, as work and living conditions are rarely monitored and reports of abuse have been rampant and widespread.
Well, just I think what I'd love to see more of in Canada is stories about domestic workers who've been brought from the Philippines. There's a tremendous amount of people in Canada who are affected by this, and there are a lot of kids back in the Philippines who are being left behind for several years while their parents, usually their mothers, come here to work and try to be able to bring them over, sponsor them over. And I think it's a greatly undertold story, but I think it's so crucial. The Philippine and Canadian government deliberately created an immigration category to facilitate bringing Filipina women, mostly women, to come to Canada to work, and they were forced to live in for a long time, that's changed, in the homes of their Canadian employers, and they were forced to leave their children behind and their partners behind and other family members behind for the benefits of our families. And so Filipino families suffered, and Canadian families, often but not always white families, benefited. And I think the tragedy in that is not on anyone's radar here in Canada. And I have family members who are in that position. And I think it's a Canadian story that absolutely needs to get out there. I think it's going to take a while, because stories about the domestic help, in quotes, are not typically everyone's preferred stories, especially not when told from the point of view, the grueling point of view of the people that actually lived through it. So I think that's a Filipino-Canadian story, absolutely based in Canadian immigration policy that was very deliberate and explicit, because Filipinos were considered to be docile, spoke English well, served well, and the Filipino government was complicit in helping that policy be put in place. And I think the toll it's taken on two generations, the parents and then the children, is absolutely enormous. And I think those families deserve to have attention to what they've been through and what they sacrificed and what they were forced to do.
I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative.